happening here?
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
Yeah, that's right.
Telling me I got to beware.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Christopher Bolin. Today's show, Architects of Terror. Christopher Bolin is an independent researcher, investigative journalist, and author. Upon graduation from high school in Cook County, Illinois, he spent the next 3 years traveling extensively throughout Europe and the Middle East, finally settling in both a kibbutz in Israel and in Norway, where he studied Egyptian, Biblical Hebrew, and Norwegian at the University of Oslo. He is the author of Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World, and Solving 9/11, The Articles. Christopher Bolin, welcome again.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
In Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World, you have a chapter entitled The Architecture of Terror, Mapping the Network Behind 9/11. This chapter includes a dizzying array of connected companies and people, both in and out of government, that were in positions to facilitate and orchestrate the events of September 11th. You met with Andreas von Bülow, the former head of the parliamentary commission that oversaw the financing of the German intelligence agencies. What did von Bülow have to say about what he termed as a, quote, sophisticated false flag operation like 9/11?
The first thing he told me was, this was in November or early December 2001 in Germany. He told me that, first of all, he suspected that Israeli intelligence was behind the 9/11 atrocity. And then he said that such a sophisticated false flag operation would involve three different levels. The first level, he said, was the architectural level. This is the people who planned the false flag crime in order to have it blamed on a third party. In this case, you know, the Arab Muslims, fanatics of Osama bin Laden. And the purpose of their false flag terrorism is to basically change public opinion. In this case, change U.S. public opinion to support the war agenda in the Middle East and to support the increased defense spending. The second level, he said, was the managerial level. These are the people who managed the setting up of the crime and then managed the deception that follows the crime. And they also, this managerial level, control the third level, which is the working level. For example, he said the working level is part of the deception. In this case, the working level would be, for example, the 19 Arabs, the alleged hijackers.
Did von Bülow have anything else to say about his opinion of this operation?
It was surprising that he said, quite frankly, that he thought it was an Israeli operation, Israeli intelligence. And I went ahead and reported that in the report that I wrote up about our discussion. And he was surprised because he had said the same thing to German journalists, but as he said, that none of the German journalists would ever publish such a statement. But I did, and he was a little bit surprised at that, that paper I wrote for would go ahead and say such a thing.
You write that there is evidence of an Israeli intelligence network connecting every key player and entity behind 9/11. The people and companies and their interrelationships are quite complex. Can you talk about a few of these networks, the people and companies?
Like you said, there's a host of them. Ehud Barak, for example, when he lost the election to Ariel Sharon, came over to the United States in the late winter of 2000 and was working in the United States, you know, for the 10 months or so prior to 9/11. And he worked with a company that was actually produced aluminum nanoparticles, nanocomposites, which is one of the key elements of nanothermite. And then there was, as you said, in that Chapter 7, The Architecture of Terrorism, there's a whole host of companies, you know, including NICE and NICE, that's an Israeli company, and others. And as I found, as I demonstrate in this chapter, these Israeli companies are all interrelated, interlinked with, for example, the scores of Israeli art students who were spying on and trying to set their stuff up in DEA offices across this country. These companies and these relationships were actually investigated after I wrote the chapter by an English editor and a fact checker. He examined 105 statements that I made in that chapter and found that all of them were correct. And this was a person in England who was actually hostile to my thesis that this was an Israeli operation. But he was hired by a publisher in Europe to check the facts of that chapter that you referred to, the architecture of terrorism, and found that all of my connections, all of my statements were in fact true.
Yes, that chapter is very complex. It was hard for me to hold it in my mind all at once because there's so many interconnections and a huge cast of characters. Now, you mentioned the art students. This is a very important point. You go into that in some detail in your book. What can you tell us about these art students? Who do we think they might have been?
Israelis who pretended to be art students. And actually, though, I think it was the DEA had done a working paper, an analysis of these students who had been arrested and who had been caught, and found that they were actually Israeli military personnel, active, who had served in or were members of demolition units. Many of them, like there was a Per Segelovitz, I think his name was, who was one of the heads of these teams, and he had led a platoon or a group of like 80 other soldiers. And their specialty was, in fact, demolition. And these people were the ones who were, you know, found trying to infiltrate into DEA offices, Drug Enforcement Agency offices, and private homes of agents of the DEA across the United States. When this information came out, this was also part of the Carl Cameron four-part series on Fox News that came out just after 9/11. But there's a tie-in. These individuals in this Israeli art student spying operation were connected to Israeli companies that were also tied into 9/11. As you said, it's very complex. What I've done is I've created a flow chart sort of thing where I have mapped out these entities and show the relationships between them. And what Israeli intelligence has done for a long time, actually, in this country, in the United States, is that they set up a company in Israel. The research and development of the company is done in Israel. Then they create the headquarters or business office for that company in Menlo Park, California, or Silicon Valley, or Boston, or what have you. And so it has the appearances from the outside of being an American company, when in fact it is an Israeli intelligence operation, 100%.
Now, you just said that these Israeli art students, so-called, at least some of them, were arrested. What were they arrested for?
They were arrested and caught when they were very aggressively trying to get into DEA offices and DEA personnel at their private residences. And so the DEA document lists the names, sometimes the spelling isn't quite correct, of these agents as they were caught, as they were observed, trying to basically infiltrate DEA offices across the country. And this was going on, I think it was in Texas and California and a lot in Florida. Most of the activity was actually being done in Florida, right around the area where these 19 alleged hijackers lived.
Well, now, do you have any opinion as to why they would be trying to infiltrate the DEA? I mean, now, there is evidence that these 19 or how many ever accused hijackers that were living in Florida were actually dealing drugs. Isn't that right?
Mm-hmm. Well, that could very well be. And the thing is that what we also know about the alleged hijackers, the 19 Arab alleged hijackers, is that many of them had been issued duplicate licenses. And when you read the details, you find that, you know, for example, one of the Arab hijackers would get the license on a Wednesday, and the very next day, a call would come into the DMV, what have you, the people who issue licenses in Florida, requesting a duplicate license issued and with the excuse that the person had moved to a new residence and had a new address. So what you have is you have basically two IDs for the same person in circulation at the same time. And many of these people had also reported having lost their passports. So what this indicates is that there were two people going around with the same ID, leaving basically a false trail in the name of the person who was to be implicated in the crime. That's a Mossad operation tactic that's been used for a long time, and it's very well described in the book by John Le Carré. He wrote a book in 1982 called The Little Drummer Girl, and it's about a similar Israeli terror operation in Europe. George Roy Hill made a film about it, but the book explains how this is done, how a false trail is left to implicate a person in a crime. That's apparently what we had with these 19 alleged hijackers. Somebody was leaving a trail in their name to implicate them in the crime. And as you say, why would the Israelis be interested in infiltrating and getting into DEA offices? probably because they were trying to do intelligence gathering on the DEA. And what I see is that the Clintons and the Bush families have been involved in this drug operation that began back in the 1980s, you know, in between the Medellin cartel, and the Israelis were involved in this. So having access to the DEA offices and the information would give them the power, especially with this computer enterprise software, to know what is going on in the DEA at any given time in real time. That's what they probably wanted.
And how would that information have benefited them?
Well, the thing is that, as I point out in the chapter of the planes of 9/11, the second chapter of the book, Solving 9/11, the Israeli Aircraft Industries, IAI, has long had a base in Bogota, Colombia. And I believe, and I think the evidence is pretty clear, that the Israelis have been involved in this drug operation from Colombia to the United States, along with the Bush family and the Clinton family. And nothing ties people more closely together than a crime committed together. And I think that the crime here is they basically took over the Medellin drug cartel operations. And this is, I think, why Philip Marshall was killed in Calaveras County a year or so ago, because he had written a book called Lakefront Airport. He writes about his experiences. It's an autobiographical novel in which he writes about his experiences being the personal pilot, the Learjet pilot, for Barry Seal. And Barry Seal was, of course, the drug smuggler who turned to be a DEA informant. And this is the crime where these families are connected. The operation, you know, was being run out of the White House, out of the basement of the White House by Papa Bush, George Herbert Walker Bush. And Bill Clinton was, of course, the governor in Arkansas when Barry Seal was flying all this massive amounts of cocaine into Arkansas. And what the problem is for them is that this pilot, Philip Marshall, knew the names, knew the places, knew the operation, and had written a book about it. And he was planning to write a fourth book. But the third book, Lakefront Airport, is very hard to get. Right now, if you want to buy it on Amazon, it costs about $600. But I just read it, and you can see very clearly that it's his inside knowledge of this drug operation, weapons and drug operation called, you know, the Iran-Contra thing. That's what put his life in danger, because he knew the names and he knew what was going on.
Wasn't his entire family killed?
Yeah, except for his divorced wife. He was living in Calaveras County. He had the two children, a boy and a girl. They were found shot on the couches in the front room, and his dog was shot, and he was found dead. And it was a very strange thing. The police in Calaveras County were very slow to respond. There was clearly an element to this crime that was, a cover-up. Wayne Madsen wrote extensively about it. He went out to Calaveras County and visited the home and the site and some of the witnesses. But it certainly appears that this man, he also wrote a book called, you know, False Flag 9/11 and The Big Bamboozle. But Philip Marshall's books about 9/11 do not put him in any sort of dangerous situation, because he basically supports the official version of 9/11. They're not the reason he was killed. The reason I think he was killed was because he had inside information, firsthand information, about the drug smuggling operation that involved the Clintons, the Bushes, and the Israelis. That's why he was a danger to the system.
You mentioned the little drummer girl. You write that John le Carré's 1983 novel, The Little Drummer Girl, is about Israeli false flag operations, and that in the preface to his book, John le Carré thanked past and serving officers of Israeli intelligence. I believe The Little Drummer Girl was also made into a movie. Yes, you mentioned this.
Right.
What is the storyline of The Little Drummer Girl, and what do you think is its significance?
John le Carré signed the foreword to that book, or the preface, in, I think it was July 1982. And that's exactly the time when the Israelis were invading Lebanon in 1982 under Ariel Sharon and Menachem Begin. But as he says in the very beginning, he thanks and he names these people. He names the former head of Israeli military intelligence for basically, you know, giving him all this information and insight about how Israeli intelligence operations work in Europe. And in this book, and in the movie, I think it's Diane Keaton plays the role. She's an actress from England, and she is basically recruited by the Mossad to help entrap a Palestinian. And she goes down to Turkey or Greece and hooks up with this Palestinian guy. And they have sort of a relationship, a romance. But the whole purpose of the book is to implicate this Palestinian in terrorism that he you know, that he's not actually involved in. Some of the scenes in the movie involve, like, Israelis blowing up a synagogue. They're not really blowing up the synagogue. They're putting charges in the window and blowing the windows out. It's all theatrics. And that's one of the key statements in the book by one of the Mossadniks. He says that terror is theater. Theater is a con trick. Do you know what that means? Con trick? You've been deceived. And that's very important, you know, to understand how Israeli military intelligence goes about implicating and setting up a crime like this so that the authorities that do the investigation following the crime come away believing and thinking and having in their hands evidence that implicates, you know, Arabs or terrorists or whatever, Palestinians, when in fact the whole thing has been basically theater. And that's what we're seeing now in much more in the United States. We're seeing these incidents like, you know, San Bernardino and Boston Marathon. We're seeing terrorist attacks or terrorist incidents where clearly the public can see that we're being deceived. The theater aspect of these crimes, of these terrorist attacks, is becoming very evident. So it's like the game is up. You know, these people are still doing these terrorist attacks. They're still doing them on a daily basis in Iraq and Syria and Afghanistan. But when they do these kinds of crimes in this country, the public has woken up to the fact that we are being deceived, and that's a really good thing.
There was ultimately an unsuccessful attempt to obtain the security contract for the New York Port Authority back in 1987. Mm-hmm. Who obtained the security contract, and how did they lose it?
Well, that's a very interesting aspect of this crime. A couple Mossadniks, these are high-level Mossad agents. Zvi Malkin is one of them, and the other one is Avram Shalom Ben-Dor. These two men were very high-level Mossad agents working under Yisr Harel, the first chief of the Mossad, and the first chief of the Shin Bet, basically. This is Israeli domestic intelligence and foreign intelligence. And Yisr Harel, he employed terrorism in his operations, and that's one reason why he was forced to resign from the Mossad in 1963, because he was involved in an assassination tactic of killing German scientists called Operation Damocles, which was being run by Yitzhak Shamir. But the thing is that these two men, Zvi Malkin and Avram Shalom Ben-Dor, came to the United States in the 1980s. These men had been involved in high-level Mossad operations like the kidnapping of Adolf Eichmann down in Argentina, the former Nazi who was kidnapped, taken to Israel, you know, tried and hanged. And they were also involved in the illegal procurement of plutonium in this country and shipping it to Israel for its nuclear arsenal. So they were very high-level Mossad players. And they came to this country in the 80s. And in 1987, they actually obtained the security contract for the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, which was the body that owned the World Trade Center. And this is the agency that oversees the ports and the harbors and the airports and the bridges and tunnels of New York City and New Jersey. They obtained the security contract for the World Trade Center and the Port Authority, and this crime of 9/11 probably would have occurred in the late 80s or early 90s had not a person at the Port Authority discovered that Avram Shalom Ben-Dor was convicted of a murder in Israel and was using a false name. And this is the person who was the president of the security company that got the Port Authority contract. It was called Atwell Security of Tel Aviv. And it was actually a company that was set up by the big Mossad guy, Shaul Eisenberg, basically Mr. Asia for Israel. And when the Port Authority discovered that Avraham Shalom Ben-Dor was using a fake name and was wanted or was convicted of murder in Israel as the former chief of the Shin Bet, they tore up the contract. And as I said, had they not torn up the contract, 9/11 would have probably occurred in the late 80s or early 90s. But it was discovered, the contract was torn up, but that wasn't the end of the operation. What they then did is Avraham Shalom Ben-Dor went to work for Jules Krull. And Jules Krull and Maurice Greenberg, they had a company together called Krull Associates. And Krull Associates got the security contract for the World Trade Center after the bombing in 1993. So you see, using the offices of this American Jules Krull, the Mossad still got into the security contract for the World Trade Center. But it took them until 1993 to do so.
Well, then, what company or companies held the security contract for the World Trade Center on September 11th?
Well, it was Krull Associates. Krull Associates, headed by Jules Krull and his son, and then involving Maurice Greenberg and his son. They were given the duty to rewrite procedures, security procedures for the World Trade Center. And they did so. This is after the bombing in 1993. The 1993 bombing in the basement was basically an FBI sting operation. It was investigated for the city of New York, for the Robert Morgenthau, the DA of New York. It was investigated by a guy named Michael Cherkosky. He was the head of investigations for New York City and for Robert Morgenthau. And then the following year, Mr. Cherkosky went to work for Kroll Associates when they became the organization that was in charge of security for the World Trade Center. And the Port Authority took all of their recommendations and put them into effect. Kroll Associates then had the security contract for the World Trade Center and oversaw security for the World Trade Center all the way through to the destruction in 2001.
Could you explain the relationship of Kroll Associates with Marsh and McLennan? Who are the people involved in these companies?
It's Jules Kroll and his business partner, Maurice Greenberg, also known as Hank Greenberg, who was the former CEO of AIG, the company that got the lion's share of the $180 billion bailout in 2008 and 2009. These two men have several companies together, and one of them is Marsh McLennan. And Marsh McLennan is the company into whose computer room the first plane struck. The very first plane went right into Marsh McLennan's secure computer center, which was in the North Tower. And Kroll Associates and Maurice Greenberg, they have several companies together. Maurice Greenberg has a whole bunch of, you know, operations with Jules Kroll. And their sons are also involved, Jules Kroll's son and Maurice Greenberg's son. Maurice Greenberg's son, for example, was the CEO of Marsh McLennan when the first plane struck their computer room. And this is very important because both planes actually struck secure computer rooms. And both computer rooms seem to have been prepared with thermite charges and things like that so that the explosion was, you know, spectacular and pyrotechnical. Those are the people. Those two characters, Greenberg and Kroll, they are very important because Kroll Associates also involved people like Jerome Hauer. Jerome Hauer had been a Kroll Associate. And he was the guy in San Diego who came on and said, you know, basically that this was the 9/11 was done by Osama bin Laden and the towers fell because of the, you know, burning fuel. Another one was Paul Bremer, who was the first head of the Coalition Provisional Authority. I think it was called the CPA in Iraq. He was basically America's proconsul to run the occupation of Iraq for the first 3 or 4 years, during which time, you know, there was no metering of the oil that was being exported from Iraq. All of these characters are at the highest level of the Iraqi invasion, the invasion of Iraq, and 9/11. I mean, even Jerome Hauer, who was a Kroll Associates employee, was the person who put the Office of Emergency Management hardened bunker on the 23rd floor of building number 7. You know, the building that fell down at 5:20 in the afternoon. So, I mean, these people are all connected. This small group of players are very deeply connected in the crimes of 9/11, and then the war in Iraq.
You just mentioned the hardened bunker in Building 7. That was, what, Giuliani's Emergency Management Control Center?
Yeah, Office of Emergency Management, OEM. That OEM was managed by Kroll Associate employee Jerome Hauer. And Jerome Hauer is the person who oversaw and made the decision to put this hardened bunker on the 23rd floor of that building. And this hardened bunker was built in such a way it would withstand even a nuclear blast, you know, in the area. And what's interesting is that the OEM bunker, the 23rd floor, was not occupied on 9/11 by the usual people. There had been a planned FEMA operation drill scenario. And so in order for this scenario to go ahead, they had removed the usual people from the OEM bunker, and they were working at another location in New York City on 9/11. So that meant that somebody else was in the OEM bunker that day. And most likely, this is where the demolition operation was carried out that destroyed the Twin Towers.
And then what happened to that OEM bunker?
Well, the whole thing came down in a big pile of debris at 5:25 in the afternoon that day. This is the third building that fell down. And, you know, it wasn't talked about very much in the media. So most American people, I mean, a good percentage of the American population is unaware of this building coming down. And this is the aspect of 9/11 that has gotten many people involved in the truth movement. People like Stephen Jones from BYU, when he discovered Building 7 coming down for no apparent reason, he became interested. And the same thing with architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth, for example, Richard Gage. This is where they begin their discussion because this building fell down into its own footprint in what's clearly a demolition operation at 5:25 in the afternoon. It was two blocks away from the World Trade Center, and it was separated by a building in between, and it just had some little fires, office fires. There's no reason for the building to come crashing down into its footprint, but that's exactly what happened. So it's one of the most obvious clues that the buildings at the World Trade Center were demolished.
Yes, and when I interviewed 9/11 whistleblower Indira Singh, she actually told me that there was, of course, foreknowledge of Building 7 coming down because she was an emergency medical technician doing triage out in front of Building 7 when the fire department around noon on September 11th had the EMTs move up to Pace University because, according to the fire department there, Building 7 was going to come down.
Yes, there's videos out there of people coming out of Building 7, like at 5 o'clock in the afternoon or 5:15 in the afternoon, and they're telling people, including Amy Goodman is in one of these videos, they're saying, get back, get away, this building's going to come down. Keep your eye on that building, it's going to come down. So, I mean, there's a lot of people who obviously knew that Building 7 was wired for demolition and was going to come down. And these are the people who had placed the charges or had prepared the building in the last minute for its destruction. There's really no question that the building was demolished and that it was planned for. I mean, even Larry Silverstein, the owner of the building, the person who built the building back in 1985, he admitted on public television that, you know, the decision was made to pull the building and then we watched it come down. He said that on a TV program. And to pull a building means to basically pull the structure so that it falls. It's a demolition term. There's no question about it. The building was blown up. As I said, this is the beginning when people realize that we have been lied to about 9/11. Every aspect that we've been told by the government about 9/11 is basically a lie.
Do you think the high-tech enterprise architecture company P-TECH was compromised? You write that their enterprise software was used to provide real-time access and control of all data and information on government computer networks on September 11th.
Yes, this is also part of Indira Singh's contribution to 9/11 understanding. P-TECH was more than compromised. P-TECH was basically an Israeli operation. It was enterprise software based in Quincy, Massachusetts, and it was what I call like a false front operation in which people were led to believe that it was a Lebanese Muslim who had set up the company and that this company had been sponsored by some dodgy Saudi guy who has some ties to terrorism. This is all part of the deception. In fact, the person who was playing the key role in the establishment of the company from the beginning in 1994 and getting its software, its enterprise software, onto U.S. military and government computers was a man named Michael Goff, the Jewish guy from Worcester, Massachusetts, who was a lawyer. I spoke to him and asked him how he wound up working for P-TECH, and he said that he had left his law practice in Worcester, Mass. He was working for a good company out there, and he left that law firm and went to work through an agency for P-TECH, which was a little startup company in 1994. And I asked him, well, what agency was responsible for your going? He couldn't remember. So I think he was not telling me the truth here. And what's interesting is that Michael Goff went on to work for the Mossad company Guardium, which is another computer software company, Guardium with an M at the end. That's a very clearly an Israeli intelligence operation. So, you know, he's working on one hand for Israeli intelligence, and on the other hand, he's working for P-TECH, this dodgy little Arab startup company in Quincy, Mass, whose software finds itself onto all the computers in the United States government and military. Well, you know, I think I pinned the tail on the donkey when I say that P-TECH was an Israeli intelligence front operation all along. This is how you do spying in the big, big picture. When you have enterprise software running on U.S. government computers, you know what's going on in the operation, in the computer network, whichever agency you're talking about. You have absolute control, surveillance operability, and control operability throughout the operation in real time. That is intelligence gathering at the highest level.
9/11 whistleblower Indira Singh said that P-TECH was with MITRE Corporation in the basement of the FAA for 2 years prior to 9/11. What do we know about MITRE Corporation?
MITRE Corporation is based out of MIT originally, and it's part of Lincoln Labs, which is a company that does all of the the engineering, software engineering, and things like that for the U.S. Air Force. MITRE Corporation is a very big defense contractor. It's based outside Boston. And these two companies were involved, as she said, in the basement of the FAA checking for and examining the relationship between the FAA and the military in the event of a crisis like 9/11. I've written a great deal about MITRE and PTEC and people involved in this. Again, there's this very strong Zionist influence in MITRE, the former CEO and the people that ran it, Rodney Schlesinger, I think it might be. But in any case, this whole operation was basically being done to prepare the understanding and put the super users in charge of how the communication would flow from the FAA to the military when 9/11 occurred. This is a very important part of the computer aspect of the crime, because as we now know, there was a drill going on that day and the air traffic controllers were completely befuddled and didn't understand what was real and what was false that day. But also the communications between the FAA and the military were thwarted and delayed so that there was no proper, effective military response to the hijackings. This is not by accident. This is done by a very intelligent foe who has infiltrated the most important and sensitive computer networks involved in defense of this country. And that's where we have a very serious problem. Israeli military intelligence has infiltrated the computer networks of the U.S. government and military so that they have this super user access to these computer networks. Later on, the NSA itself took encryption software from an Israeli company. And I called up the NSA and I said, how is it that the NSA, you're the signal intelligence of the United States of America, you give your encryption software, you know, responsibility over to a foreign country? They had no problem with that, they said. But I mean, that just gives you an idea of how infiltrated our computer networks are. And it's the same thing what we found out later when with this revelations by Snowden, and I think it was Assange, but the Snowden revelations revealed that in San Francisco, the companies that were involved, I think one was called Prism, another was called Narus, these two companies that were involved in the splitting of the rays and sending the data in real time directly to Israel were both Israeli companies. So what we find is that, you know, at the highest level and the computer networks in this country, military and government, they're completely infiltrated and controlled by Israeli intelligence. Even the cybersecurity czar for the Pentagon was a guy named Amit Yoran, and he's an Israeli, and he and his brother ran these network of hackers, friendly hackers, whatnot. But these are the people who wrote the security protocols for the Pentagon for the security software. And he was the cybersecurity czar for the United States of America, and he's an Israeli citizen. You know, this is how bad it is.
What is the Site Intelligence Group? Who runs it, and what do they do? That's SITE.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's very important. Site Intelligence Group is a Israeli intelligence website operation based in Bethesda, Maryland. The front person for this organization is an Israeli intelligence agent named Rita Katz, K-A-T-Z. And she works out of Bethesda, Maryland. And what this group does is it provides the video feed coming from, for example, ISIS. One of their main clients or main subjects is this Islamic State group in Syria and Iraq. So when we see videos supposedly coming from this ISIS group, what is coming to us through this Israeli intelligence website called Site Intelligence Group. And so what it basically means is that our understanding of this Islamic threat in Syria and Iraq called ISIS is most of the time primarily coming to us through these Israelis. And that's very important to understand. This is a good example of how U.S. military and U.S. media view the Middle East through Israeli spectacles, because they are the ones who are providing us with the so-called intelligence, the propaganda, the videos, what have you. And so it's very much like the wag the dog, you know, theme of the movie, in which videos are being provided to us from an Israeli website supposedly portraying this latest threat to, you know, peace in the Middle East. That's very important to understand, because when, for example, the video of the second American being beheaded came to CNN and Fox News, it came from Site, and Site admitted on CNN that Site Intelligence Group had released the video before ISIS had released the video. And as Rita Katz said on CNN, well, this is because we had a copy of the video beforehand. Well, how did the Israeli intelligence have a copy of the video beforehand, before ISIS had actually released the video, unless they're inside the camera? This gives you an idea of how close Israeli intelligence is to this ISIS operation.
We are dealing with the real Makai. We are dealing with the real Makai.
Something happened in there.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to be aware. Why won't we stop, children? What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Bad lines been drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speaking their mind, getting so much resistance from behind. Why won't we stop, children? What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Stop, children, what's that sound?
CM Farmer.
What a field day for the heat. A thousand people in the street singing songs and carrying their signs. Mostly say hooray for their side. Why won't we stop, children? What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Stop, children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
Ready with the real Makai.
Miss if he stop, he stop, he stop, he stop, he stop. Miss if he stop, he stop, he stop, he stop, he stop, he
stop. Ready with the real Makai.
Paranoia strike deep into your life, it will creep. It starts when you always afraid. Step out of lines, a man come take you away. Why won't we stop, children? What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Why won't we stop, children? What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Won't we stop, children? What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
My car.